Okay, we are in Perek Tesvav, chapter 15, excuse me.
Wow.
And
I have a question.
Already?
Yeah, I remembered it.
Okay, go for it.
The brain never works that well. So, last week everybody was commenting about the babies. They were very affected by those babies being slaughtered, and none of us liked it. I don't like meat.
Yes.
And we understand, yes, this was God's idea, and we have to respect it. But then, and the rabbis and all the commentaries we've gone through seem to reiterate that, yeah, God's in charge and we do what he wants. Are there any commentaries, perhaps women commentaries, who say they didn't kill all of them, or they see a midrash another way, or they didn't really kill the babies, they hid them somewhere?
So I have not seen commentaries that suggest that. The closest you can get to that I've seen is the suggestion in the Dat Mikra edition by Professor Keel, who suggests that because they were sparing the animals, they were involved in the spoils, therefore some of the Amalekites were able to get away. But
not necessarily children.
Correct. I will note, if you read Toronto Torah, which I believe you should read religiously, you will see an interesting idea begun. It's not really the full idea. In the Tanakh column, it happens to be that our Tanakh column, Journey Through Tanakh, on page 2, is up to this chapter this week. And Ezra Diana wrote the summary. We always present the summary of a chapter in Tanakh and then a little bit of an insight. And he quoted a Rebbe of his from the Yeshiva Taras Moshe in Israel, Rabbi Shurkin. And if I remember correctly, Rabbi Shurkin argued that there was no obligation of literally wiping them out to the last. Now, I have to say, I don't know how that fits, because he said to him, man and woman and all that. Nonetheless, he argued that it's a command to defeat Amalek so soundly that they're not functional as a nation anymore. And then there's a separate command of getting rid of the animals, the spoils, and all of that, which we've talked about also as a possible separate command. We talked about that from Abar Benel, the idea that you have to demonstrate that this isn't a war for conquest, that this is a war with other other motivations. So he argued that, and he actually, his point, and the point that Ezra brings it for, is to say that Shaul is not responsible for failure in sparing Agag. That's not a failure. In other words, he did defeat Amalek as a nation. His failure is in terms of the spoils. That was actually where the failure was. Then why does Shmuel insist at the end of the chapter on killing Agag? It's because, as Shmuel says, because Agag is a murderer. It's a separate thing. So I haven't seen this idea from Rabbi Shurkin. He reported it from a shir, a class he heard from Rabbi Shurkin. He didn't have something in writing from him, so I can't point you somewhere to look it up. But that's about it for what I've heard. And the text, seems pretty clear, certainly about what the instruction was. But yeah, that's what I have. Okay. So we are, as I said, in Perek Tedvav, in chapter 15, and we were in the disobedience. So we had started on this section, sentences 4 to 9. We had read through it, we had asked certain questions.
And we're in 2, and it's Shvut.
I'm sorry? Okay, we are in chapter Tedvav, that is true, and it is Shvat, yes. So we said that Shaul's sin is not the sin of mercy for Amalek, rather it's disobedience. That's really the problem. We did note a case in Melachim Aleph where there is a king who is punished for inappropriate mercy, and that was Achav. But that's not the case here. And we brought evidence of it from the text itself, where it says Vayachmol, which we think means he was merciful, but it doesn't fit. He destroys so much. To call him merciful is really hard. Not to mention, you get this response from God, which is found in the Midrash, but it's based on the Pasuk in Perek Chaf Bet in chapter 22, when it comes time that David gets help from the city of Nov in escaping Shaul. Shaul says to Doeg, I want you to wipe out Nov, and he used the same language that God used here, and it's taken as a rebuke, effectively, to him. The fact that it's recorded in this way, highlighting that Shaul lacks mercy. And Malbim was the one who really took this approach and said that the word chemla is different from two other Hebrew words that we associate with sparing something. One is rachamim, and the other one is chas. Correct. So he took the view that rachamim is mercy that you have on another person. Specifically, it's mercy on a human being. That lachus is an emotional type of thing. I have a connection to this, I feel close to it, I have a use for it, something like that. Whereas chemla is a rational statement of, I don't think it's right to destroy this. Whether I have a use for it or not, don't have a use for it, connection, no connection, it's intellectual. I don't see destroying this, and that makes it a disagreement with God. But now what I wanted to do is take that one step further. Yes? Chus v'rachim, which fits very well
right.
with Malbim.
Right.
The
right.
two go together as opposed to chemla, which is really different.
But it's also interesting that, and I wonder whether this is part of Hashem's motivation, and I don't have as much trouble as everybody else does because if Hashem says that it was the right thing to do and maybe that's why the neshamas were there just for that reason, I don't have a problem with that. But maybe the
You're
idea
right.
was don't.
You're right. You have as much problem as everybody else does.
I know. I would have a big problem if you asked me to do it. I would have a problem personally. And I hope that every single person that was in the war had a problem with it personally. Like, this is difficult. But not that I'm more compassionate than Hashem, and I know better than Hashem.
Right.
So I just understand. Think that's it. But whether part of the reason was if Shaul was kind of fooling himself into thinking that he was a merciful person, because a lot of times we rationalize what we do,
right.
and I'm doing this for a merciful reason. Clearly it was not, because if it was mercy, then it would be exactly the children that were spared, not the animals, and not the
king. I definitely hear the idea, and frankly it fits the complexity of human beings.
Right.
You know, at the same time, it's not what I've seen brought, but I understand where you would, where you could say that. So take a look at sentence 5, because we noted something odd when we read it. Shaul has been given the instruction. He has rallied the nation for war. He has done his census. And Vayavo Shaul ad ir Amalek. He comes to Amalek. We're going to come back to some of the elements from that sentence where he rallied everybody for war. But I'm just doing this, if you remember what I said last time, I'm doing this as an introduction to what happened. And then we'll go back over the psukim and answer for some of the strange things we've seen. But in particular, it says Shaul comes to ir Amalek. City of Amalek, cities of Amalek. In and of itself, that's strange, given the fact that they're nomads. But let's say it's the enclave. It's wherever they are camped. Vayarev banachal. The word vayarev usually means, and he fought. A riv is a fight. So ostensibly, that means he started the war. However, it then says, Shaul said to the Keni, get out of Dodge. Right, leave Amalek, lest I destroy you with them. You have been so good to the Jews. You were great when we came out of Mitzrayim. And the Keni leave. And then Shaul strikes Amalek. Right? And then Shaul strikes Amalek. So I don't understand. Where is the fight? So if I'm a literalist, I would assume that the Yorev Banachal is perhaps a preliminary stage of the war. The Radak suggests that. He says Vayarev doesn't actually mean and he fought, but rather it's from the Hebrew word Aleph Resh Bet, which is like a rove to ambush.
Mm-hmm.
So he laid an ambush for them.
That's
what you were going to say. So Ricky's with Malbim on this one. We're not around Malbim, excuse me, with Radak, not Malbim.
All of them.
Sorry, all of them. Okay. Abarbanel offers this suggestion. Take a look at source number 1. He says, "Sheigia le'ir hakrova me'ir me'arei Amalek." He got to the closest Amalekite city. V'yidmesh Amalekim yatzul krasam limnoa mehem mehanachal. He says, presumably, what happened was Amalek wants to block them from getting the water of the nachal. Right? Nachal, remember, is a wadi.
After their old tricks.
So they want to block us from getting it. But initially, at least, well, my English notes that we wouldn't have water to drink. So it's a preliminary stage. Malbim goes a step further with the idea that it's a preliminary stage. And he says, this is actually an intentional preliminary stage. You see, Malbim says, Shaul feels like it's not good to just go right out and attack Amalek when they haven't done anything to us today. So what I'm going to do is find a pretext. So take a look at Malbim. Ein michukei hamalachim l'tagir, yeah, well, sort of. L'tagir melchama below eze ilah. He says, it's not the way of kings to instigate a war without an ilah, and ilah is a cause. If you remember the story of Yiftach, so Amon is attacking Klal Yisrael, and Yiftach sends them a letter saying, what are you starting with us for? Right? And Amon's memorable response is, because 300 years ago you came through here, and yeah, we owe you one. So Bikesh Shamariva Benachal Shlefnei Amalek. So what he does, what Shaul does, is he starts a fight in the wadi that's in front of the cities of Amalek. Shaul Amar Shanachal Vavika Shayachilav. Shaul said, that's mine. The wadi is mine. This area is mine. Va'amalek Ravi Malzeh, and Amalek fought with him, saying, no, it's ours. Achizehi ilata milchama, and that became the cause for war. Right? I mean, nations do this down to this day. This isn't something that was prehistoric and doesn't happen anymore.
And if they hadn't taken the bite bait, then would he have? He would still. He was under command to kill them.
So correct.
If he hadn't taken the bait, what would he have done then?
I don't know. Maybe he would have ramped things up. But what Malbim says is this is part of the sin. He says, "V'gam zemoresh shelo kiyem mitzvah karaoi." This also demonstrates that he doesn't do the mitzvah properly. Shelo ha'ilo l'vakesh rak tzibah m'pnei she'Hashem tzibah. He's not supposed to go looking for some kind of a cause. God told you to. That's it. This is about a war for God. Remember what they did to you in the Midbar, in the wilderness. It's not about needing some kind of justification for it. If you make it look like it's because of some new conflict, then you lose the point. Exactly. So that's one school of thought. Vayarev Banachal was an introductory phase that was maybe preliminary to the battle. Ricky?
Nachal is a stream or a river. Wadi is a dry.
Correct. So sometimes Nachal is used to refer to a river. However, often it's used to refer, or a stream, yes, but often it is used to refer to a wadi.
Dry.
Yeah, an area that's dry until it floods. A wadi is dry until it floods, and then you have water there. So we've seen that before. In here, in particular, in Shoftim, we saw Nachal Kishon in the war that Devorah fought. And as it plays out, especially if you look at chapter 5 in Shoftim, it was dry land, and the horses and chariots of Sisera and the Canaanites are attacking us, and then out of nowhere there's a flood, and at that point they're stuck.
Yep.
Okay. Yes, Diane?
And by Yarev, could it be the Shoresh Rov, Harbe?
You mean he rallied the troops there?
Or the Amalekites gathered there, like the people gathered. They went to gather his people, the people on one side, and the Amalekites...
So, it will be an interesting idea, but then you have literally zero antecedent. Meaning, in Tanakh in general, we have trouble with pronouns that don't have antecedents, and it happens all the time, so the fact that it didn't say Amalek right before that isn't ironclad proof that it's not so. But, Amalek hasn't been the protagonist at all in this story.
Or even Shaul gathered in the thing.
Right, so if you were to say Shaul rallied his people there, you'd have a stronger argument. It's a little odd grammatically, but I wouldn't think it's beyond the pale. I think it could be. The other way that you would look at it from a literalist perspective is that it's simply an overview. Shaul came to Ir HaMalek, and the battle happened in the Nachal. And here's what happened. Shaul said to the Keni, get out of the way. The Keni moved, and then Vayach Shaul et Amalek. He struck Amalek. That would, to me, that would have been the simplest way to read the story. However, the Gemara reads it differently. In source number 3, now, in order to fit everything on one page, I had to sandwich together two Gemaras that we're going to be reading. We actually want the second paragraph in source number 3. In other words, the Gemara that we're quoting is from the second half. half of what you see in source number 3. I could have just flipped the order of the paragraphs, but that's not the way the Gemara presents it, so that's not what I'm doing. So we want, if you're looking at the Hebrew, Vayarev Banachal, if you're looking in the English, and he fought in the Wadi. Okay. And he fought in the Wadi. Vayarev Banachal. Amar Rabbi Mani. Al Iske Nachal. Rabbi Mani said, I'm not sure why I wrote Rabbi there. It's not. It's not, it's Rabbi Mani. He's the, what was the fight? Al Iske Nachal. It was about the matter of the Wadi. What in the world are you talking about? No. And the answer is, we have a parsha in the Torah with a mitzvah that relates to a Nachal. It is the mitzvah of Egla Arufa. The mitzvah of Egla Arufa, in brief, is the following. In the event that a body is found outside of town from somebody who was murdered, you don't know who it was. You have no way to track down who it was. So the elders of the city that is closest to the body have a ritual to perform called Egla Arufa. And it's part of a declaration that they were not responsible, which, as it's explained in the Gemara, is the idea that we didn't fail. It's double negatives. Bear with me. Those who have just flown back from India and Israel, we'll take it slow. We did not fail to provide for the traveler on the road. Which, the way it's read in the Gemara is, meaning, there was a traveler. If there was a traveler we didn't provide for, maybe that person goes out on the road without an escort and got attacked and was killed. However, as Rashi on the Gemara reads it, it's, no, we didn't take care of him, and therefore he had to go attack somebody in order to get food, and he got killed in attacking somebody. I'm responsible for the fact that he turned to an unsuccessful life of crime. That's the way Rashi reads it. But either way, the elders in this passage say, no, that's not what happened. We took care of everybody. We don't know how this happened, but it wasn't because we were remiss. And part of what's done is that they kill a calf, an egla, in a nachal. So the Gemara borrows that nachal, and that's what you see here. About the matter... I'm sorry. No, they do not eat it. No one's allowed to benefit from it. It's not a sacrifice. It's a statement of destruction. It's not kosher. It's not, no, nothing. No one uses it. So, B'shah Sha'amalu HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Sha'ul Lech V'Yikisa Es Amalek. When God said to Sha'ul, go strike Amalek, Omar, he said, Uma nefesh achas amra Torah havei egla arufa. If for the sake of one life, right, one person got killed, and now we have to go do this egla arufa in the nachal, kol nefashos halalu al achas kama v'kama. You're telling me I should murder all these people in from Amalek? How can that possibly be? Sha'ul says, I can't accept I can't accept such a command. That's unconscionable. And he tell me, okay, the people of Amalek are wicked, wicked, evil people. They attacked us. People sinned. But what about the animals? And if you're going to tell me the adults sinned, what about the babies? There you go. That's Shaul's objection, as read in the Gemara. The Gemara says that a voice comes out of Shemayim and it quotes Koheles, which... Don't take it literally as quoting Koheles, because Koheles is later. There is some discussion about that, and some of the commentators, not on this Gemara, but the Gemara has a few places like that, where a line that will become a pasuk later in history is used earlier. And whether that means that the same sentence was stated and there was divine inspiration involved or whatever, or whether it just means this captures what was said, either way. Aldi tzadik harbe, don't be such a tzadik. Or don't be overly righteous, as I translated it, but I prefer don't be such a tzaddik. But then you get to that pasuk we referenced earlier, right, where Shaul says to Doeg in the city of Nov, I want you to go kill the Kohanim, and it's the same language of Olel, Yonek, and all of that, as we saw last week. The voice comes out and says, the next pasuk in Koheles, don't be overly wicked either. The message here in this Gemara is that Shaul disputes God's order. There's another Gemara, Shabbos Nunvav, that brands Shaul as somebody who fights with God because he, in fact, opposed the command. So you're seeing here, rabbinically now, a matching to what we saw already last time in the Psukim, which is that Shaul's problem is a disobedience to God. He's not willing to accept the divine command, which fits with what we saw in his first mistake, with the Karbanot. Although, granted there, he had reason to do it, meaning he had waited, and he panics, he says, I have to bring a Karban before the war, what am I supposed to do? But what we see here is that the commentators believe the problem with Shaul is not his mercy. He's not being punished for being merciful. It's his failure to function as God's king. He is instead a human king. And that goes all the way back to the people's request for a king and what they wanted and what God said they're not going to get. And the answer is because everyone has a chance to make their mistakes. He could have done differently. This wasn't foreordained. This is what he did. Otherwise, you could say, why create human beings at all? So that's what I think we're seeing here is Shaul's sin is the fact that he rejects the divine order, and it's much worse here than it was back in Perek Yud Gimel. Okay,
it's very specific here.
Oh, it's very specific, and it's very intentional. There's no pressure on him in this situation. It's not like he's responding to something. We don't see the nation rallying and yelling at him and saying, how could you do this or something. He's going to say, the nation pushed me. We're going to have to talk about that. But now let's go back and see some of the technical things here, because there's a lot going on in these psukim. So first of all, counting sheep. Right? Vayif gedem bat tila'im. So if you remember, back in chapter 11, when they fought their war with Nahash of Ammon, right? Nahash was the one who threatened Yamesh Gilad, knock out the right eye, the whole bit. So there, he also counted his army. We said he counted them in Bezek. And there we had two different views. One view was that Bezek was just a place, Bezek. We know a place called Bezek. There was an Adoni Bezek earlier in Navi. The alternative is that Bezek or Bezek were shards, that he distributed shards and then counted up the shards, and that was how he counted the people, rather than count them directly, because you're not supposed to count individual Jews, as we're going to come back to in a moment. Here, too, Radak suggests that Tla'im could be, and I think, Tova, you said last time that was what your text said. Yes. So then it could be a place, just like Bezek could be a place. However, the Gemara assumes that Tla'im are what they sound like, which is sheep. Because that's what the word means. He counted sheep. He counted them by counting sheep. Everybody went to sleep, and when they woke up, Amalek was gone. No, sorry.
It's also patches.
That's funny, yes, you're right. We use that term for a patch as well, but I don't think that's what's meant here.
Well, but everybody tore a piece of his clothing. And
which is very popular in Shmuel, tearing off the piece of clothing. You're right, but I've never heard that suggested here. Hey. Put that into your commentary. So if you go back to source number 3, the beginning now of that Gemara in Yuma, it assumes that both the Bezek story and our story are indeed means of avoiding counting individuals. Aser limnos es Yisrael afilu dvar mitzvah, says the beginning of source number 3. You are not allowed to count Jews, even for the sake of a mitzvah. Dechsiv, as the Pasuk said in that first war where he was defending the people of Yavesh Gilad, Vayif Kedim beBezek. He counted them with Bezek, that's the shards.
So how do you count people for Minyan?
So you don't. Either you do one of these things, like you distribute something, or what people do is they don't use numbers. They use a sentence in Hebrew which has 10 words, and they'll just go to each, and you complete the sentence.
Right.
So you have a menu, she has a menu. Another one is the bracha hamotzi.
Sorry, I didn't.
The people will use.
What is that one?
Hoshia et hamecha, barech et nachlatecha, ur'im v'nasa'im ad olam.
I don't remember that.
Okay.
It's a song.
Yes. So people have a. Although I'll tell you something. Once you've lived in a place where they have trouble getting a minion, you become actually very familiar with just eyeballing it. You can just look at a group and you know there's 10. Yes.
Well, 5 it's bizarre, is the largest number that you can count without actually doing that.
So I can just say, okay, this is more or less. The way it works, no, I think the way it does work, in truth, and just mentally, is that you just naturally break them into discrete groups.
Yeah.
So you see it, and you just, boom, there's 3, 3, 4. You know, okay,
no,
we're good. You know?
You'll have to count the groups.
So, no, you're not. But no, you're not counting. It just happens automatically. Like, I can tell you,
like,
I'm sitting right here,
and there are 4. I'm not counting anybody. I quickly see
you. You just perceive it.
You already, in your mind, you know.
Let's go through here, because you're going to see why...
One quick question. This question, the surly
show,
is that an actual pursuit?
That's where we're going with this.
I know, but is that an actual pursuit?
No.
They don't have
no.
They're home with it.
Yes, yes. But what we're going to find out here is why. When you understand why, then you'll understand why counting with numbers is uniquely problematic. No, I really want to see this.
I'll ask you later.
Maskev l'Ravashi. Ravashi asked, Mimai dahai bezek lishna de mivzaku, v'dilma shema de masahu. He says, how do you know the word bezek means shards? Maybe it was the place. He counted them in a place called Bezek. After all, we have the pasuk, v'yimtzu adoni bezek. Rather, he says, from here, from our case, we counted them batzalaim. He's not willing to assume tzalaim is a place. He says, of course, it means sheep. Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar then says, kol hamona es Yisrael over belav. If you count Jews, you are violating elosase. There's a prohibition. What is the prohibition? Because the Torah says, this is not Torah, this is Hoshea, v'hayom mispar b'nei Yisrael kechol hayam asher lo yimad, that the count of the children of Israel will be innumerable, like the sand at the sea, beyond measure. Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak says, I have a better one. I have a pasuk with 2 prohibitions. Lo yimad velo yisafer. They will be they'll be immeasurable and they will be uncountable. So if Hashem gave us a bracha saying that the Jews will be innumerable, how dare you number them? That's the idea, which is why using the pasuk of Hoshea Hamecha or the bracha of Hamotzi or eyeballing the groups is okay, because you are not assigning each one a number. Yeah, Hamotzi works also.
I can do that.
Good. What were you going to ask before? You were going to ask something? I said to wait until I finish that line.
I'm sorry, it's not related. It has to do with the minion. I'll ask you later.
Okay, good. These are ways to get around counting, because we're promised to be without number. What's particularly odd here, I didn't bring it on the sheet, is that Rashi, on our parak, when he talks about not counting, uses a third pasuk. He uses the pasuk in Bereishis where we're told that we will be asher lo yisafer meirov. That we would not be countable because there would be so many of us. So I don't know why Rashi brings a different pasuk. Maybe because the Gemara's psukim are from Navi, and Rashi wants you to have a pasuk from Chumash, because the psukim that we're bringing here are from after Shaul's time. Like, we're bringing Hoshea, you know? He's not around in Hoshea's day. So, I mean, Hoshea's not around in Shaul's day. So by using a pasuk from Chumash, maybe that works better. I will also note that Abarbanel, I didn't bring it here, and I didn't bring it when we did it in chapter 11, because it's just way too weird, brings an odd biological explanation for why counting people it can actually be harmful for them. It's out there. It's out there. It's
curious.
It's like eye and hara related, but like that something emerges from the eye.
Sounds like superstition.
As well as the classic answers are rational answers, dividing people from the community, from the merit of the community.
Well, what about the chatzi shekel? I thought we were not counting because of the chatzi shekel.
That's an example of
exactly
counting people
right,
by not
that's
counting.
That's how we learned it from
right
there.
So the Gemara here is saying no. The Gemara also notes, I didn't bring it on here, but the Gemara notes that he used sheep this time, pottery last time. Right? What happened to the pottery? Why is he using sheep now? So the Gemara says it's because he's king now. Now he's got sheep. Who needs shards? That's the Gemara's explanation. The Radak quotes Targum Yonasan to suggest these aren't just any sheep. These are Karban Pesach animals.
Oh, Chris.
So these are special. So I guess that means it's Pesach time, number one. The number two, these are special animals. Okay. Question. Someone asked this when we were reading, and it's a good question. The same question came up in chapter 11. Did you notice how the census plays out? How many people are there?
210,000
210,000. Why did we count Yehuda separately?
Right?
The same thing was done back in Perek Yud-Aleph, in chapter 11, when they did their war for Yavesh Gilad against Nahash and of Ammon. So Abarbanel said at the time that this is like what he said back in chapter 9. In chapter 9, when we asked the question of how you could appoint someone from Binyamin as king, didn't Yaakov say that the scepter shall never leave Yehuda? Abarbanel's answer was that Yehuda is always going to stand apart as the leader of the Shvatim. So Abarbanel said, it doesn't mean that the king is going to be from them, but that they'll be the lead tribe. So therefore, they're going to be counted separately. Which makes sense compared to another suggestion that I had thought of, which was that maybe their group, their representation is larger. If you do the math, it's not true.
No.
Right? There are 200,000 from everybody else, and there are only 10,000 from them. That means they're actually underrepresented. Mm-hmm. So that wouldn't
work.
Maybe
that's because they're so strong.
Oh. Must be. Everybody said to them, well, your warriors are so good, we don't need too many.
We don't need too many.
Yeah. I don't think so. But you should keep an eye on this. Because the separate identity of Yehuda becomes a very big issue with David. So keep an eye on the fact that Yehuda is being counted separately. Okay. Next thought here ties into this week's parsha. Pasuk Vav. Shaul says to the Keni, leave Amalek, lest I destroy you with them. After all, you did good things for the Jews when we came out of Mitzrayim. What was the good thing that they did for us?
I told Moshe how to organize it, so we should go and
right.
ask God.
So, Diane gives Radak's answer. Radak says, we know that the Keni are descendants of Yisro. Yisro himself is a Keni. So Yisro gave Moshe the advice to have a judicial hierarchy. Moshe apparently was new to the whole idea of government and just never dawned on him that you don't have one person running everything. That's a joke. If you look at Abarbanel and others, they ask that question. Why did Moshe need someone to give him this advice? It really is kind of intuitive, yeah? But nonetheless, that's the good thing. That was the chesed. That was the kindness of the Keni. That's Radak's approach. The Gemara Brachos gives a different explanation, but it's not clear what the Gemara means. Take a look at source number 4, please. The Gemara is talking about something else in context. It's talking about reward for doing good things. And it says, V'halo dvarim kal v'chomer. Watch this logical argument. Uma Yisro shalo kirevis Moshe alechvod atzmo. Yisro only brought Moshe close in order to honor himself. And yet, look what he got. He got so much out of this, meaning he got protection that they were saved from the war with Amalek. So too, how much more so if you provide for a Torah scholar? In other words, Yisro only provides for Moshe selfishly, and yet he gets reward. How much more so if one does something lishma, perhaps? So the question is, what are you talking about? What was it that Yisro did that we're talking about? Rashi seems to say it's the feast that Yisro made in our parsha when he arrived. That Yisro made the feast on behalf of the elders, whereas Radak says no. It's inviting Moshe. He already gave you one answer, the judicial hierarchy, but he says it's inviting Moshe home when Moshe saved his daughters. That's the idea.
Nobody wants to credit to Tzipporah for having done the bris. That would be nice. Like, she could get covered for that.
That's true, but again, she's not viewed as a Keni anymore.
Huh.
Maybe that's why. You're right. She saved Moshe. That's a pretty good deal. Abarbanel notes here, and it's seen in the Medrash in Shmos Rabbah, it's also seen in a Radak, that Yisro is the anti-Amalek. Both of them hear what God did, and Amalek comes and attacks, And Yisro maybe converts, maybe doesn't convert, but certainly joins us in one way or another. Radak is going to say... Yeah, Radak is going to say, it's going to be in source number 6, and we'll see it when we get there. But the position of Radak is that actually Yisro's arrival that's recorded in Parashas Yisro doesn't happen before the Torah is given. It actually happens in Parashas Baalotcha, in our second year in the wilderness. There are a variety of reasons for that. There's a Gemara in Zvachim about that. But he argues the only reason that it's moved to Parashas Yisro is so that it'll appear side by side with Amalek, to highlight for you the difference between Amalek and Yisro, which leads to very interesting things. Number one, the fact that Amalek is punished in the future because of what they did back then, and Yisro is rewarded here in our story because of what they did back then. That's what the Medrash points out. That's number one. Number two, there are other times when they are juxtaposed. It's not only B'Shalach, you know, what we just are reading in the Torah now. It also happens, obviously, in our story here, but also with Bilam. When Bilam gives his message of what's going to happen in the future, it says, Vayaretz HaKeni, he looked at the Keni, and he said, you guys are safe. And he saw Amalek, and he said, oh, you're going to be destroyed. So they're side by side in Bilam's predictions as well. The Torah likes to juxtapose the two of them. Okay. So here's the other question, though, that you have to ask, and it's going to lead us to a little bit of an uncomfortable place in this whole story. It's going to reopen the whole Amalek discussion, for which I apologize, mostly to myself. But why, if the Keni are Yisro's descendants, possibly even Jewish, why are they living with Amalek?
Why are they there?
Seriously? Like, someone just said, you know, there's cheap real estate over there, and somebody else said, yeah, but look at the neighborhood, and they said, yeah, but cheap real estate. Like,
well, who was there first?
Well, that's a good question. We know Amalek are nomadic.
So it could be the Canaan were there, and Amalek came, and they just didn't want to fight. They let them...
Want to leave them. Do we know that the Keni are nomadic?
So that's going to be one of the questions, because we actually believe the Keni are nomadic.
Yeah, because the Bedouin, I think they claim themselves to be from neutral.
Yeah, that's interesting. That I did not know. Ricky?
Were they part of a Shevet?
So, yes, it seems like they were. Not biologically, but let's worry about this.
Then they wouldn't have to live in a Shevet or area.
Right. The problem is they were part. Well, let's see. Let's go through this step by step. Keni, the name clearly seems to trace back to Kayin, right? But not necessarily that Kayin.
His good cousin.
Because there were a lot of people who were from Kayin, right? But after the Mabul, there was really no one. Because, I mean, unless you're going to say through Naama, that Naama is Noach's wife, and she's from Kayin, but the Keni wouldn't be around. In Gracious, it's in chapter 15, sentence 19, I did not bring it for you on the sheet, we are introduced to Canaanite tribes, and one of them is the Keni. Keni, Knizi, Kadmoni. However, what are you looking for?
15:19,
okay. You'll see it. However, the Keni are not listed with the Canaanite tribes later on. When we get down to the 7 Canaanite tribes, Keni ain't one of them. So Radak, which we're going to read shortly in source number 6, isn't quite sure whether the Keni mentioned in Parashas Lech Lecha in 15:19 are the same as the later Keni who Bilam is going to refer to, who is Yisro and all that. But he thinks they are. He thinks it's one Keni nation down the line. What Bilam is going to say about those Keni is that they are going to be safe in the future. And again, Radak thinks those are the same people as the ones we see here. But there's one other mention of the Keni that you need to know in order for this to all fit together. And that is Perek Aleph, Pasuk Tet Zayin in Shoftim, which of course I didn't bring on the sheet, but I ought to have brought it, so I will tell it to you. But it's Shoftim 1:16. This is, if you remember what's going on at the beginning of Shoftim, because who doesn't remember what's going on at the beginning of Shoftim? This is our introduction to the state of the Jews after Yoshua. And the opening two chapters plus talk about some of the conquests and some of the stories that we saw back in Sefer Yehoshua, and introduce us to the spiral, the downward spiral of the Jews during the period of the Shoftim. And we are told there that the Keni descend from Yisro, that they have been living in Ir HaTamarim. Ir HaTamarim is also known as Yericho, Jericho, where Jews are not supposed to live. So maybe they were in Yericho, near Yericho, and they moved to be with Yehuda. And that goes back to Ricky's question of, are they with a tribe? It seems like Yehuda adopts them.
Oh.
They live among the people of Yehuda.
And the commentators...
Well, yes. And the commentators tend to assume that they are Jewish. That they... Whatever Yisro did personally, that these descendants are indeed Jewish. According to Rashi and Shoftim, they moved to be among Yehuda, and they moved away from Yericho because they wanted to learn from Asniel ben Knaz, who was the Shofet back then. That's the that's where they want to be. Take a look now at Ralbag in source number 5, which will fit with this very well. B'nai Keni, he's commenting on that verse in Shoftim about how they moved from Ir HaTamarim to be with Yehuda. B'nai Keni Chosein Moshe Shavu L'das Yisrael. The children of Keni, Moshe's father-in-law, he uses the word Shav, which sounds like return, meaning they had been there and had left. Yeah, unclear. Ulezeh Yeshuas Yehuda, and that's why they live with Yehuda. They want to be Jewish. That's why Ralbag reads it. Radak goes even further, and he says they marry among Yehuda. They, Radak says that in Bereishis as well as in Shoftim, but they are nomadic, which is how they end up with Amalek. So take a look at source number 6. The Hebrew is the bottom one side. I'm going to stick with my English that I did at the top of the second side. The Keni were named for the city they inhabited at first. The city's name was Kayin. That was the city they came from. As in Shoftim, and Chever, the Keni, separated from Kayin. If you remember that story, what's that story?
Yael.
Right, Yael is the wife of Chever HaKeni. That was the pasuk that we read, but we didn't know what was going on, because it was in the middle of the setup of the war that the Jews are going to have with Canaan. It suddenly halts the discussion to tell us, oh, by the way, this fellow Chever moved from east to west. All right, Roberto's going to remember that, because we did the whole thing with the fruit here at the time. Right. The idea was either, there was a machlokas, either the Chever saw what was developing in the war and moved in order to be in position to help the Jews, or alternatively, it's just describing something that had happened earlier because now it becomes relevant. The Chever is in position to help. But that just adds to our chain of Keni history, right? We now have, think about it, we've got the reference in Parshas Lech Lecha to the Keni as one of the tribes in the area, in Canaan. Then you have the story of Yisro, who apparently is a Keni, even though he's living in Midian. Then you move forward to Shoftim Perek Aleph, and you find that the Keni had been living in Ir HaTamarim, and then they moved from there to be among Yehuda. Then in Shoftim Perek Dalid, you find out about Keni who are decidedly not in Yehuda. Chever is way north to be in that war with Canaan. They're definitely running around. Like, they're not staying in one place. There's no way that you have... You're in Midian, right? You're in Midian in the story with Yisro. You're in Ir HaTamarim, somewhere in between. Then you end up in Yehuda, and then you end up in the north to be involved with the war with Canaan. It doesn't make any sense unless this is a nomadic group. And then finally, over here, the Keni are living next door to Amalek, which is we're going to find out is in the south, which makes sense because that's among Yehuda. So we have their fifth location in the in these passages. And remember, there isn't all that much time between the first four. Meaning, from the time of Yisro living in Midian, and when we last left him, when the Jews got out of Mitzrayim, he was living in Midian. So from then until the beginning of Shoftim is a period of 68 years, right? 40 years in the Midbar, 28 more years in under Yehoshua. And then Devorah is already 120 years after the beginning of Shoftim. So there I could understand the they're shifting. And then, of course, from Devorah's time until Shaul's war with Amalek, that's centuries. So there, you could already certainly see the that they're moving around. But either way, going back into this line in source number 6, he says the builder of the city may have been named Kayin. He named the city for himself. They married among the tribe of Yehuda with the families of Rechev, which is based on a verse in Divrei HaYamim, Chronicles. Or, he says, maybe the Kayin mentioned here are others. Maybe not. Maybe. We're just seeing a bunch of people who are named Kayin, but they're not the same Kayin. But he has a problem with it, because he says, Onkelos, on the Pasuk there in Bereishis, where we mention the Kayin, Onkelos translates Kayin as Shalmai. Shalmai, those who were Shalem, complete, or those who made Shalom, those who made peace with us. And it's the same word that he uses when Bilam says what he says about Bayaris HaKeni, he saw the Keni, he also calls them Shalmai, suggesting that it is in fact the same identity, it's the same group. Ricky, you were going to say?
You put it together so well, I couldn't have done better.
Okay.
Don't ask me to repeat it.
Don't ask me to repeat it either.
Yeah. Is there any significance that they were among the men of Yehuda, and they talk about how many men,
10,000.
That there were 10,000 from there, and they came to the city of Amalek? So now it's like, were they there? How'd they come?
So the Yehudas were the locals, you're saying?
Like, was there any...
If we didn't have the fact that Yehuda was counted separately also in the war for Yavesh Gilad, which was out of their territory,
right.
I'd be more inclined.
Right.
And we had no Kayin involved there at all. But yeah, the Kayin thing is so fascinating. I should have put a timeline on the sheet just to show all the different references to them. I didn't think about it. But you've got, in Parashat Vayelech, Bereishis 15:19. You've got it again with Yisro. You have it again in Bilam's message in Bamidbar 24. You have it again in the beginning of Shoftim, where they have two different places they're living. You have it again in Shoftim Perek Dalet in the story of Devorah. And now you have them here. You just can't get away from the Kayin.
They survived.
And they survived this also.
Is the repetition also to underline a sort of lineage behavior? So, you know, against the Amalek, you have people who were bad, who continue to be bad, who will be bad in the future. You have the people who are good, who were good in the past, who were good in the present, and are good in the future.
Yeah.
It provides a very... a good dichotomy, I think.
Right. I think it is part of that contrast. And every time we do that, I cringe a little bit because I don't like the idea that we're going to really determine their identity, their spiritual identity by race.
Right.
And we've wrestled with that issue in other contexts, on other occasions. It is what it sounds like, you know, as you read Amalek. And again, commentators deal with that in various ways. So the Kayin, we are then told we're living in Yehuda. And then I brought you this other Radak in source number 7. And this is the one where he makes the comment about our Parsha this week and that story not really being from the beginning of our Parsha from before Matan Torah, but actually belonging in the second year in the wilderness. I'm going to, for clarity, I'll just stick with my translation. And he went and settled with the nation. Vayelech vayeshev es ha'am. That's the pasuk in Shoftim, where it talks about the Kayin living with Yehuda. This speaks of the head of the Kayin, because it's singular. He went. So it's the head of the Kayin, and his family went with him. And they dwelled there with Yehuda in Midbar Yehuda, the Judean desert. The text does not say why they ascended from Irat Marim, the city of dates, or whether they lived with the Kanani there. Perhaps they were with the Kanani there. For Yitro was not with the Jews, right? The Torah says in Parshas Yisro, Vayelech Lo Al Artzo, he went back to his land. Now he has to digress. I want to explain why he digresses outside of the text, because otherwise it doesn't make any sense. The problem we have with Yisro, in terms of understanding his conversion, is tied into the problem of the ending of his story in Parshas Baaloscha. Meaning, in Parshas Yisro, it's very clear. Yisro shows up, bringing Moshe's wife Tzipporah, bringing the sons Gershom and Eliezer. He spends some time there, and then it says he went home. Vayelech Lo Al Artzo. He went home, like the pasuk that's quoted here, because it is the pasuk quoted here. Then, in Parshas Baaloscha, as the Jews are getting ready to leave Har Sinai and move towards Israel, Yisro says to Moshe, it's time for me to leave.
He left
already. We never saw him show up. What do you mean, it's time to leave? Where have you been? And that's a very strange thing. And then Moshe says to him, no, don't go. You're like our eyes in the desert. And again, you're like, when? When did that happen? They haven't gone anywhere. What does that even mean? They, so...
just left.
And then, it just hangs. Right, that's it.
It doesn't tell us anything.
It doesn't tell us what happened next. Moshe said, no, don't go. And then we move on in the story.
Did you stay?
So we don't know what happened. So, what Radak does here is to say the two stories go together. That what actually happened was, after the Torah was given, Yisro showed up with Tzipporah, with Moshe's kids. Yes, that means they missed Matan Torah. You know what? They already missed all the Makos, and they missed Kriyas Yamsuf. So, you know, once you're missing all those things, Matan Torah, fine, we'll convert later. But the idea here is, they saw the movie, but the idea then is that they show up later on, and after they've been there for some period of time, at that point, Yisro says, time for me to go. Moshe says, please don't go. And then, Vayelech lo el arzo. He in fact, does leave. Vayelech lo el arzo. Yisro went home. That's the way that Radak reads it. And now he explains for you here what we've already referenced. He says, Uparshas, going with my English, sorry, we're trying to be clear. He says, the portion of, and Moshe said to Chovav, which is what's in Baloscha, when they're getting ready to leave Har Sinai, and the portion that's in this week's Torah portion in Yisro, and Yitro heard, were simultaneous in the second year after the Exodus from Egypt. And Chovav is Yisro. How do I know that? Because the text says, from the sons of Chovav, Moshe's father-in-law. So, until you find Moshe marrying somebody else, which there is a story about, but it doesn't fit this.
Is it after this?
No, the story about Moshe marrying somebody else would have been long before this, but more to the point, his father-in-law would have been Ethiopian. Not Chovav here. The portion of, and Yisro heard, is written out of place in order to join Yisro's story with that of Amalek. For Amalek harmed Israel when they left Egypt attacking them, and therefore God saved the matter for the end of all generations. Amalek harms us. This is that parallel that Nanette was talking about. Amalek harms us and Hashem doesn't forget it. And Yisro benefited Israel, rejoicing in their benefit. Benefited them with his counsel, whatever that was. And God guarded this good for him for the end of all generations. For it says that they dwelled with Yehuda, and Yehuda gave them space to dwell in their land. There you go, Ricky. And they returned to the law of Israel. There's that phrase which we also saw in Rabag. They become Jewish. And during Shaul's time, they dwelled with Amalek, for they lived in tents and traveled from place to place. They is a reference to the Cainim. The Cainim, Radak says, were nomadic. Now, we have other places that seem to indicate they're Jewish. The Gemara Nazir talks about learning from what Yael did when she killed Sisera, what type of weapon she used. So there is that assumption that they are Jewish. I have you know, two problems with this idea that they're Jewish. Problem number one is, how then can Shaul say, move away from Amalek before I attack them so I know you don't get hurt, otherwise I'm going to kill you? Right. Like, that just seems wrong. That's problem number one. I don't think it's not an insurmountable problem, but it seems odd. That's number one. Although, yeah, again, I mean, it's not entirely inconsistent with some of the things that we've seen. Like, we wipe out Yavesh Gilad because they don't show up for the fight in Pilagish Begiva. You know, things happen, so to speak. But that's one. The other problem that I have, and this is what reopens the Amalek problem, is why didn't Amalek attack them? It's not only a question of why are you living among Amalek? It's also a question of, if Amalek hates us so much, right, that we need an eternal war against them and they can't stop fighting with us, and we saw stories in Tanakh, it's true. They seem to be managing just fine with the Cainim here. Unless you're going to say it's because the Cainim aren't descendants of Yaakov, and they had animosity towards Yaakov, which we talked about originally. But I really wonder about that. Yes, Ricky?
And there's number three. Number three is, if there were Jews, then their numbers would have been in with the army.
Unless you'll say, because they're not descendants, again, of those tribes.
But if they're part of Yehuda, then they should have been in Yehuda's armies.
Maybe.
Number three.
Right. Write it down. The answer could be that they were. Mm-hmm. The answer could be that they were.
Oh, you just made that up.
No, Jeanette did.
I thought about it when she asked that question before.
Could they be
that? Maybe the eligible men were part of that.
Who knows? Right.
We don't know.
Yeah.
Could they be the extra 10,000 from Judea?
Unlikely. I think Yehuda is the extra 10,000. Otherwise, it would have said the Cana.
Yeah. But they were living.
But we're identifying them as separate here. Right. We're giving them their own identity. The other thing to be aware of is just that it mentions here the war is fought mechavila ba'acha shur. From chavila till you arrive at shur. So Rashi tells us that this is the Negev, which makes sense because it means that they're in Yehuda, right? So that works, and Yehuda owns the Negev. It also fits with chavila is mentioned back in Parshas Noach as a son of Cush. So Cush has sons who spread out in that area, so the Negev in Israel is apparently part of that. Also, we find that Yishmael lives there, that he lives in Chavila. So that actually works very well, because we know Yishmael also is in the south. So the takeaway from all of this, from everything that we've done today, as I see it here, is that Shaul spares Agag and the spoils. It's a function of disobedience rather than mercy. And we also get the contrast between Yisro and his descendants and Amalek and their identity and the way that God treats them over time. Okay? Next week, God willing, we're actually going to